Okay, what's up, everybody? It is a pleasure to see everyone. We're going to start a new series today. We're doing a four-part series. The topic is Judaism, a value system, or a legal system? And intuitively, I think we all know that it is a little bit of both. But let's before getting there, let's try to appreciate some of those ideas. A number of the questions that we're going to be dealing with throughout the course of the next few weeks are the first one, which is it a value system, is it a legal system? How Torah conveys values, how Torah conveys laws, what happens when there's a clash between values, what happens when there's a clash between law and value, and who determines those values? Is there morals outside of the Torah system which determine the value system? A lot of interesting and important questions which we'll be dealing with over the course of the next few weeks. Today our topic is how the Torah conveys meta ideas, not just an idea, not just a law, but how the Torah conveys values, bigger system ideas. I'd like to start off by thanking our sponsors this morning for today's share first. And I'd like to start off by thanking Rosemary Fish, who is sponsoring today's share upon the yard side of her sister, Dr. Linen Dumont, Leah Esther Bas Devora Rivka Leah Shalom. She should have continued Aliyah's Neshama Be'ezras Hashem. We also want to thank Chaya and Josh Glickman, who are sponsoring for Chaya's father's upcoming yard side this Wednesday, Mr. Sol Schoenfeld. Shlomo Ben Pesach David, Olav Hashalom. And I Be'ezras Hashem, I hope that the Neshama is a continued Aliyah's Neshama in Gan Eden. And those who knew him should Be'ezras Hashem have continued nachas from him, and those who knew his children have continued chizuk from his memory. We also want to thank Marilyn and Elliot Lauer, who are sponsoring upon Marilyn's mother's yard side, Mrs. Judith Abram Steinberg, Yehudis Libis, Bas Simcha HaKohen. We're coming up on the fifth yard side this year, and obviously somebody whose leadership has transformed our community and beyond. And we are beneficiaries. Be'ezras Hashem, we should have continued nachas from her and her from us as well. And we also want to thank Barbara and Yitzhak Siegel, who are sponsoring for Yitzhak's mother's yard side, Mrs. Rose Siegel, Sarah Rasa Bas Rafael. We thank them for being with us from afar. Be'ezras Hashem, and Shama should have an aliyah. Let's learn Torah together. So it should be obvious. Oh, thank you so much. Is there anybody who needs an extra source sheet? Oh, there we go. Mosh, thank you so much. Thank you, Bobby. Thank you so much. If anybody needs the extras, they're right over here. Let's start with this topic at the very beginning. It should be obvious to us that every legal system has values behind it, because a system which is simply a legal system will not succeed, because the ideas that birthed that legal system clearly were meant to be conveyed. It's just very clumsy to convey values when you regulate action. That's the problem that exists. So I have an idea. I want society to be governed in a certain way. So I set up a law, but inevitably there's going to be problems with that law. And when you have a society which is simply a by the letter, living by the letter, or living by the loophole, essentially, society, we will come to problems. And in fact, the Gemara describes that this was one of the reasons why the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, was because of such a society where they decided that Judaism was a legal system rather than a value system. So as an example, take a look at Source 2, the Gemara of Abin Siesta. This is amongst a much larger discussion about another topic. The Gemara says, Asher Yasun, quoting a pasuk, that a person must perform, and the Gemara explains, or Darshans unpacks those words to mean Zu lifnim mishura sadin. That is going beyond the lishura sadin. Shura sadin literally means the letter of the law or the line of the law. It says Da'amar Rabbi Yochanan lecharva Yerushalayim ela al shodanu ba din Torah. The Jerusalem was destroyed because the court systems exacted din Torah, the law of Torah. So the Gemara says Eladina demezigo de ledaini. So wait a second. So the decision making should have been completely arbitrary, right? It should have been based on another legal system. What do you expect the courts of Jerusalem to issue their verdicts based on? So the Gemara then says, "Elo ema shehemidu dinei malzin Torah v'loy avru avdu lifneihem lifnei mishra saden." They never demanded beyond piety. They never demanded something more than simply the letter of the law, and they let the case lie just as is, because technically speaking, the person who did X really doesn't need to pay for such a situation, because technically speaking, There's a very famous and well-known effect which has been named now called the Cobra Effect, which was based on actually when the British were in control of India. And there was a problem in New Delhi of cobras. There were too many snakes in the city. So what the British did was they set up an incentivization system where anybody who would come in with the skin of a cobra would be rewarded duly. And what they found is after the first few months, not only was there not a decrease in the amount of cobras in the city, but there was an increase in the amount of cobras in the city, despite the fact that they were actually shelling out a huge amount of money. Because what some very very innovative individuals did was they started setting up cobra farms, right, in order to be able to claim the rewards, right? This works in all kinds of situations. And there was down in Kentucky where they had an incentivization program to hand in firearms. They gave a price for firearms, and they found that the first people in line were the gun dealers who had went to the nursing homes to buy off the guns of the elderly to bring them in for money. And the second people in line were the people who were trading in their old guns in order to be able to take the money to contribute towards their new automatic rifles, right? So, meaning the idea of living by the letter of the law doesn't work, right? There must be something bigger. And then the question that we have to ask ourselves is, well, how do you convey something bigger and how do we understand something bigger, both on the side of the lawgiver and the law, so to speak, abider, the citizen in that society? How do we get there? Those are the questions that one would need to ask. And Judaism, I think, struggles with these things. It would be much easier to have a value system, but then value systems are too airy-fairy, right? You can't talk about just value systems. You need to have a legal system. But once you have a legal system, then you get the literalists who just say, well, that's what it says in the book, and therefore this is the only way we need to do things. And so the question of today's topic is, if there are values, which we definitely assume there are, the Gemara is saying that we are punished for not having noticed them. So how does the Torah convey that to us? Where do we look to find those? And so the argument today is very simple, that there's three avenues in which the Torah does this, and we're going to look at each one individually. And they are prescriptive, descriptive, and inductive. Because let's take a step backwards and appreciate them. Prescriptive. And that is that sometimes the legal system will actually talk about values. It'll talk about meta ideas, ideas which are beyond the specific minutiae of a particular action. So let's think about those together. Can anybody think of a prescriptive value? The Torah says, keep a value, not a law. Keep a value and not a law. Okay, so that's an interesting one. So what Paul's suggesting is go in the ways of God, right? So, by the way, that actually is reduced to laws, right? Mahu rachum ata avata rachum. So it does reduce it to, or mahu mevaker cholim af ata mevaker cholim. So the Gemara reduces that, so to speak, distills it into actions, quantifiable actions like bikur cholim and levayas hameis. But that is a good example of where the Torah gives you a big idea, and that big idea has to be understood or defined, right? But you need to be godly, right? A being like the divine. That's an example of that. Any other sort of data come up? Good, loving your friend like yourself, yes. Okay, good. And again, by the way, notice that the Gemara will reduce these. The Gemara will say, this is what it looks like, right? Because we need it to be tangible. But in the end of the day, the Torah is giving it to us in a bigger sense. I'd like to discuss three, which are very famous ones, but they affect us on a daily basis as well. And that is the beginning of Parshas Kedoshim. It's called Parshas Kedoshim because the Torah tells us, Kedoshim Tiyu, be holy. Okay, I want to be holy, so what do I do? How do I be holy? So Rashi tells us, the word holy, the word kadosh, always means, good morning, Rosemary. The word holy means what? Rashi tells us, separation, right? So Rashi tells us the holiness is related to separation, which means that I need to be prushim. I need to be separate. What is the separation from? Rashi tells us immoral relationships, right? It says you want to be holy, then make sure that you distance yourselves, make sure not to be a little too close or comfort for those who are ones not supposed to have a relationship with. However, the Ramban very famously tells us that there is a meta principle at work here, which is bigger than the law. Rashi's telling us this is a law, right? Meaning, there are relationships which are forbidden, so distance yourself. That's really a tangible law, right? The Ramban says it's more than that. Take a look at source 4, and this is such a very beautiful, beautiful idea which we come across, and it's sometimes emphasized but sometimes forgotten. Va'inyan, he says, the law idea over here is, when you talk about inyan, that's not a law. Inyan is the idea, right? The matter. Ki ha-Torah hizhira ba'arayos v'melachos ha-asorim v'tzira ha-biya ish b'ishtoi v'achilas b'asav v'yayin. There are certain parameters. There are certain things we're not allowed to eat. There are certain relationships we're not allowed to engage in. But there are certain things we are allowed to enjoy in life. There is the opportunity of the sexual activity within marriage. There's opportunity of indulgence when it comes to food. There's much that Jews can eat, and look at the menus just down Central Avenue, folks. Right, what's available today? It says Imkain Yimtza Bal Hatava Mokom Lios Shatuf Bezimas Ishtoy on Ashav Arbe Harabois Lios Besove Yain Bezolele Basel Lamoy.
It is quite plausible for a person to be completely indulged in life, living an indulgent life within the parameters of the law, right? Whether it be within the confines of their marriage, within the confines of kosher, within the confines of free speech. They can say whatever they want, do whatever they want, act however they want, and essentially be what the Ramban calls, the outcome is naval, is, well, how do you translate that word?
Disgusting.
A disgusting person within the bounds of law, right? So you can clearly have missed the boat. You're supposed to be what a Jew looks like, and you are acting simply like what a heathen looks like on the street corners in Russia, who can't put two words together after their drunken stupor, but that's how you are because it's mutter, technically speaking. Right, that's what the could be the outcome, and therefore he says lefichach ba'akosu v'acharei sheperata esurim she'asar legamrei v'tziva b'divrei klali b'dvar klali sheniya perushim min hamutaros or mosros, that a person should exercise additional caution. A person should be that to take in all these laws to an outcome yema'et v'mishkal, and he goes on to describe that a person should be. Should be balanced in the way they interact in this world. And skipping down to the next paragraph, he says, this is where this general mitzvah comes, this value-based mitzvah. The Torah tells us some very specific red lines. And that's what it means when it says Viskadashtem Elu Maim Rishonim, Visem Kedoshim Elu Maim Achronim, Ki Kodosh Zeh Hashem and Orev. And then he goes on to say how Chazal are going to quantify some specific items, but the idea is meant to be is think about exercising caution, think about exercising balance, think about what the Torah wants of us, not just what us to do, technically speaking. And there again, the Ramban is addressing this particular idea of being a naval birshus haTorah, which is very plausible and unfortunately is not so uncommon in when it comes to legal systems where people just live by the letter of the law. Another example, the Ramban says, and this affects us today, is the Torah tells at the beginning of, in Parshas Emor, it says, it talks about, it's actually referring to Rosh Hashanah, but it's a law which applies to Shabbos as well. He says, Yelachem Shabboson, it will be a day of rest. So Shabbos and Yom Tov are meant to be days of rest. What does it mean, Shabboson, rest exactly? So he says, in the second paragraph, the Ramban again, in the second paragraph of Source 6, says, Nirali, Shamedrash Hazeh Lomar, Shenitzavinu min haTorah liyos lanu menucha b'yom tov afilu midvarim she'ena melacha. We're demanded to rest, to cease from activity, which may be mutar. Because technically speaking, based on biblical law, I could really carry a lot, and I could end up, you know, sweating a lot as I bring my produce from the granary to the storefront, and I'm measuring it so I can really get ready to sell. And I can clear this, and I can move that, and I can set up my shop over here, because that's technically not, there's no actual, I'm not doing Harisha, I'm not doing Zariah, I'm not doing any of those activities. So we'll set up a city that's going to have an Eruv, so we no longer, it's going to be surrounded by a wall, so we won't have a carrying issue. You are Musim ala Chamorim. And then we'll have the entire marketplace will be open, right? Because we'll have it avoiding all the technical biblical problems. The store will be open. And the store owner is crediting. Why crediting? Because he doesn't want to. He doesn't want to do right. He doesn't want to write because writing is the problem, right? Everybody's dealing with money, because money, technically speaking, isn't an Isadar, right? V'yiyu ha'poalim mashkimim le'melachtom b'mashkirim atzvom b'kachol l'dvarim ha'ilu v'kayetz v'ahem. And the workers, okay, all the other problems, will just hire people to do the rest, right? They'll be switching on and off the lights because these are all not biblical, right? So he says, v'hutru ha'yomim ha'yomim tovim ha'ilu. And there will no longer be yom tov. V'afilu ha'shabes atzmo shebechol zeh. Ain bohem yishum melacha, because technically speaking, it isn't melacha. Lakach amra Torah Shabboson sheyiyeh yom shavisa umenucha loy yom Torah v'zeh pirush tov yafeh. And the Ramban says, here is what it's meant to look like. I'm giving you what it's meant to look like. It's meant to be a day of rest. Yes, there's 39 basic principles, and they have subcategories, but that it is not meant to be just that. And therefore, by the way, so how is this remedied? So what, how do we fix this? What is the fix for the concern that he says the picture that he's just painted for us? What happens? Good. So the Rabbonim, Chazal, set up certain Gedarim, which means, just to appreciate what's happening over here, and this is important for the next topic we talk about, that means to say that Chazal looked to the meta principle, right? They looked to the value of Shabbason, and they said, we need to tighten those loopholes, right? We need to make sure that it won't look like that based on the principle what we know the outcome is meant to be. Does that make sense? Okay, so now, which means that Chazal have a part to play in the expressing of the values. That's an important step of understanding what Chazal are doing, and we'll try to get to a little more to that next time, is what the role of Chazal are in this. But this should be obvious as to what the end is. And I believe that's the same thing that happened with electricity, to be honest. Right? If you look at the original, like when electricity is starting to become commercialized, so we're talking about the mid-19th century, okay, the mid to the end of the 19th century. And then the halachic decisors are starting to talk about, are you allowed to not use, but switch on electricity? Is the question. Switch on and switch off electricity. And there's a great debate at the beginning, because at the beginning there was a discussion about havara, lighting a flame. And that's because the initial electricity was used for what purpose? Electricity and for light, and the way that they used the way that light was achieved in those days was by huge resistance, which clearly was Havara actually at the very beginning, right? If you read about the initial light bulb attempts at the beginning, I mean terrifying attempts around the turn of the 20th century, and what they were just in the late 1880s and 90s as to the run for the patent towards the light bulb before Edison, and what they were doing in public in London and Paris. I mean, people died when they touched these things, these incandescent bulbs. So initially there was an idea that this is Havara. And then there was the Machlokes, the Chazonish, and Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. This is Boine or Makabe Patish. But I would argue that whatever the technical, so to speak, vehicle for the Isser was, there was an understanding already that this is a problem with Shabbason. And thank God. Right, thank God that the Rabbonim of the time had such intuition. Because imagine what today would be like if electricity was mutter. Imagine how un-Shabbos dick it would be. Yes, sorry.
Isn't that where we have something like Ode Dechol, like something that whole?
Yes. So they even created a category of Ode Dechol. Now it's so hazy, it's so gray as to what that is. Right, you know what specifically? That also again has parameters because not everything is Ode Dechol, and sometimes you'll see it thrown in as a. But you're right, that's another example where Chazal is saying there's something. And actually, interestingly enough, it's actually a small category, ironically, in terms of halacha, because most of the rest of it is regulated based on this. But what do you see over here is that there is Shabbos, but there's a principle of Shabbos. And that principle of Shabbos sometimes needs extending or applying in certain cases. Where, based on one word, the Torah tells us this is what it's meant to look like. And we know what it's meant to look like, and somehow 3,300 years later, after Sinai, we're still getting that right. We're still getting most of that right as well. These affect lots of very complicated decisions that affect communities. I'm not going to get into some of the more complicated questions about what Shabbos should look like in our locale, on main areas, in the relationship of restaurants, as an example, being open on those times is a very tough topic. But these are some of the questions which are asked as a function of this. One other example of this, but there's the Torah tells us at the in Parshas Devarim in Parshas Vayechanan, it says Vasisa Yashar Vatov. What is it? How do you translate that roughly? Yashar Vatov. It's very hard to write. Yashar usually means like straight, and Tov is good. Well, that's a little too broad. So again, the Ramban tells us this is a meta principle. He says that listen to how beautiful this is. He says in Source 8. Ula Rabbi Seinu Bozer Midrash Yafev Amruloi Zup Shara
This means compromise and going beyond the law. In source 8, I apologize. First, the Torah tells you what to do. Now it tells us, okay, now I've told you what to do. Just apply that. Be a good person. Be a nice person. Be an upright, be an honest person. As an example, Ki oev atov yashar v'zeinian gadol lefi she'iyashar lahaskir b'Torah kol hanhagos ha'adam im shcheinov v'reov v'kol masayim atonov v'tikunei yishuv v'amidinus kulam. The Torah simply cannot enumerate every single human interaction. It can't talk about the neighbor who's parking their car halfway across the driveway of their friend. It can't talk about the person who puts a cone by the public parking spot in order to It can't talk about double parking. It can't talk about every single iteration of non-menschlichkeit that arises in society. He says, Aval, acharei she'es kircha mehem harbei kagon, lo telech rachel, don't be a talebearer, lo takum lo tator, don't take vengeance, don't stand by and downfall your friend. Don't curse the those who cannot hear. Stand in front of the elderly. So it says then, just get the message and do it. Be that kind of person that Torah asks and begs of us. But technically speaking, no. Stop it. Stop waving that finger and just act like a good person. That's what the Torah is telling us. And the Gemara actually gives an example of an expression of this law. And it actually quantifies this into Shulchan Aruch. What's the halacha? It's called Dina de Bar Metzra. And what's Dina de Bar Metzra? The Gemara Baba Basra talks about. So let's say you have neighbor A and neighbor B. And neighbor B is selling out. He is moving to a new neighborhood. He's moving down south. And he's going to sell his field. So it is upon him, it is incumbent upon him, for him to first offer the field to neighbor A before he opens it to open market. Why? Because it is more useful to A than it is to anybody else. Because A can now have a double plot. And if he has a double plot, he can now start bigger. He can start, it's not just that he's got A, one and one, which gives him two. He can now make a warehouse, which he couldn't make when it was just simply A. And therefore, you have the responsibility. Similarly, when it comes to inheritance, there's Din de Bar Metzra. When it comes to, let's say, one of the properties is adjacent to one of the brothers, and the other one is in the French Riviera. But the fellow on the French Riviera says, well, technically speaking, I'm older and I would like to take that field. No, you have to give it to the other sibling who is adjacent because it's more useful to them as well. That's, again, a quantification of this idea as a whole. I remember that I once had embarrassingly, a number of years ago, I had a situation which was one of those hazy, grey things where we tell ourselves, I'm sure it should technically be right, right? And we went into, and we got into the situation, and somebody was very upset about something that we did. And I went to Rameh Twersky, and I said to him, Rebbe, like, you know, technically speaking, right? So he says, I want to tell you a story. And I've told the story a number of times, but it's important to reiterate it. That when Rav Moshe Soloveitchik used to live out in Eastern Europe, this was now in the, I believe, the early 1920s, and a particular disagreement was brought in front of him between a Jewish employer and a non-Jewish employee. And they both respected him, and they brought this case. It was a payment issue. And as they were sort of explaining the case, in Yiddish, the Jewish employer said in the equivalent in Yiddish of, he says, Rebbe, cut me a good deal, which essentially is an admission of guilt, right? So he says, Rebbe, cut me a good deal. And so Rav Moshe Soloveitchik stood up and he hit the table and he says, you pay him right now, right? Meaning you're not going to play games, you know, Jew, non-Jew. And start like, you know, backpedaling, back channeling, and that was the end of that. That was the end of that. A few years passed. A knock on the door at 10 o'clock at night, and this non-Jew was in. He says, "They're coming for you tonight. Get out." And that was the reason Rav Moshe Soloveitchik made it to America. Because Rav Moshe Soloveitchik made it to America, guess what? His son, Rav Yosef Soloveitchik, also later on afterwards made it to America, and we're forever indebted and grateful. And that's just because he was an honest person. And that was because he was an honest person. And Rav Twersky says, he says, I don't really care if it's technically all right. He says, but you should not be in such a situation. You should never be in a situation where it's gray, where you have to rationalize to yourself. that it's all right, and I'm sure that if looked at it by at a particular angle, the error with parallax would help us. No. you have to be out, Yashav Akasha. If there's ever a rationale that comes in, and I'm sure that, then you know you're on the wrong side of the Yashav. So again, so this is what we call the prescriptive, where the Torah actually, from time to time, will tell us, big principle, this is what we're supposed to be getting at, and even though technically there's not enough time for the Torah to indicate every minutia, this is what it's supposed to look like. Some of these are expressed in Chazal, some of them are left open to us, and we have to make those decisions. Sometimes we have to make very hard value-based decisions, which are not technically in the book. That's idea number one. Now it gets a little more complicated. So these are the easy ones, because the Torah tells us this. It's not easy to apply them. I remember I was actually at a shiva house. Dr. Huberfeld's father passed away a number of years ago, and I was sitting at a shiva house. And a fellow walks in, nobody knows who he was, and he sits there for a while. He gets up, and at the end, I was there, and he says, you know, I was an employee in the supermarket a number of years ago, and he always used to pay his employees on time. And then he said, I'm Malcolm Menachem, and he walked out. Folks, if we could be on the other end of that, for the end of our lives, we could have an employee saying that he always used to pay us on time. That's really important. Just understand that, you know, despite all the exigencies and all the things, that's us as a Yashav HaTov, just doing the right things. Right now let's talk a little bit about the next stage. This is called descriptive, and this is a question that the first Rashi in the Torah asks us. Is like, let's cut to the chase. Rashi quotes Rabbi Yitzchak and says, why does the Torah start at Bereishis? I mean, we love the stories; it's fantastic, it's so exciting. But in the end of the day, tachlis. Let's start at Parshas B'Shalach. That's when we get national mitzvahs. That's when we become a nation. Let's talk about what it's all meant to be. And what Rashi's essentially saying is, why do we need all the stories? Just tell us what it's all about, and we'll listen to it. Let it be a textbook of law, right? 1.1.1a, right? Do X, right? So you should now count the new month, because this is going to facilitate in order to make facilitate festivals. Here's what festivals look like. That's what it should be. And so what does Rashi answer in this case? Just interestingly enough. Right, why is the Torah started, Rashi's? Right, so the Rashi says it's about the land of Israel. And interestingly enough, he says that the strength of his actions he gave to his people, that Hashem gives and takes land, depending on what he wants. And I always wondered, like, why isn't that nobody's ever, like, you know, the Israeli ambassador to the UN doesn't just whip out this Rashi and say, folks, I don't understand, why are you telling us that we're thieves, which is precisely what Rashi said, is they going to say? Just pull this Rashi and say, it says, well, all of Genesis, folks, is to tell us that we own it. And nobody seems to ever take that as a given. So the truth is, I think that Rashi wasn't talking to the UN. Rashi was saying, Koach ma'asov higid la'amor. Because the boss like, we need to figure that out ourselves first. We need to stop doubting it. There was a greater percentage of evangelical Christians in this country who voted for the move of the embassy to Jerusalem than there were Jews in this country. So we got to start being proud of our heritage a little earlier than everybody else. That's where it starts with, which again, by the way, is not a law. What is it? It's a value. And so therefore, the Torah actually goes to great lengths to tell us these stories, because embedded in the story is a value. Sometimes in moments of weakness, I say to myself, I look in the mirror and I say, aren't rabbis just glorified storytellers? You know, because in the end of the day, like, you know, you can give these drushes and you can give all these ideas and so on. And then you're like, you know, you throw in a joke and somebody comes in and says, Rabbi, that was just so great, that joke. That was like the best drush I've ever heard. And like that, you know, so the idea. Yeah, but the joke was just fantastic, Rabbi. It was just, you know, that was the best drush I've ever heard. And 5 minutes later, they don't even remember the idea. You know, it's just about the story. It's about the joke. It's, you know, they say, how does it work? How often can you repeat? So they say, you know, for a joke, you have to wait, you know, a good few, 6-7 months or so. For a story, maybe about 3 months. And for a Dvar Torah, between Friday night and sort of Shlishis, is all right, you know? That's enough time for repetition. You know, all tongue-in-cheek. But the point is that sometimes you just wonder, isn't it a sad moment? So I actually had the opportunity just recently of spending time with the Rosh Hashiva of the Yeshiva Greater Washington, Rav Aaron Lapiansky. And he was just here in the Five Towns. There was a number of rabbonim who had the opportunity of spending time with him, and I asked him this question, and we were talking about this, and he said, you know what? He says stories are the greatest vehicle for conveying values, and in fact, that is precisely the way to convey values more than any ideas, more than any thoughts, more than any loops in logic. really the way to convey ideas is through story. It's the way we do it. And that's why the most successful of ideas, the most transformative of ideas come through stories. And the Torah recognizes that, and that's why it starts in such a way. Where the Torah is not just telling us our cultural beginnings, and it's not just telling us our stake in this territory. It's telling us more than that. It's telling us who we are through the way they act, and we're supposed to replicate that. As an example, the Sefer Netziv, the Rav Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the Rosh Hashiva of the Yeshiva in Velazhin, wrote a Pirush on the Torah. He wrote a number of Pirushim on the Torah, but one of them was called Ha'emek Dabar. That's the most accessible of them. And in his introduction, he talks about the names of each of the books. And he gives a different name for each book than the ones that we usually use. So as an example, instead of Genesis, which is essentially the book of creation, what's the word that the name of the book, or the first book of the Torah that he uses? Anybody familiar? He calls it, based on a Midrash, Sefer HaYashar, the book of the upright, of the straight. What does that mean? So he says, in source 10, V'gam lama mechuna ze sefer biyichud bekinu yesharim. Why is it called the book of those who are upright? U'bilam yispalel al atzmoy sheyeh achrisoy k'moy ba'alei ze hakinoy. That's what Bilam, a non-Jew, Gentile, pray that he would have achrisoy, his end would be like yesharim, tomos nashi mos yesharim. V'ainyan, Hashem is yashar, Hashem is upright. The shevach yashar who neemar lahatzdik din hakadosh baruch hu b'churban bayis sheni shayador ikeshub saltal. There we're saying that Hashem, you are right in destroying the Beis Hamikdash, even though we thought otherwise. That they might have been great righteous people who studied Torah, and that's pretty much what the Gemara Bava Metzia was saying, is they had so much Torah and so much of a Torah society, and they were just so corrupt as human beings. That was what was happening then. Al Kain, mibnei sinas chinam shebelibam ze. And this sectarian group and that sectarian group were all killing each other. Listen to Dr. Abramson's incredible lectures at the end of the realm of the second temple, and hear what was really going on over there. And these could have been really pious individuals who were holding to the letter of the law, and yet they're completely intolerant of any other group. Right, it seems almost prescient in terms of what's going on today. What's the same society ripping itself apart? Ubaya de zeli de shvichus damim bederech haflaga, and it led to terrible bloodshed. Until the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, most of the destruction was done before the Romans came as a function of infighting. That's why we talk about Hashem. What's the tzidduk aden tzadeku? Yasharhu. We're saying that Hashem was righteous because he's yashar. Shakosh baruch hu yasharhu ve'enu sovel tzadikim ko'elu. Hashem does not appreciate righteous people who are not upright. Ela ba'ofen shecholchim b'derech hayashar gam alichos olam v'loi ba'akmimus af al gav shimun l'shem shamayim. Dezegorem churban abriya v'arisos yeshuv ha'aretz. And he says, and that's what it means by the avos. So zeh hayo shevach ha'avos shemilvad shayu tzadikim v'chasidim v'oi v'Hashem ba'ofen ha'yoser yashar od hayu yasharim. The way that they dealt with even the Gentile neighbors who had nothing in common religiously, they were Yesharim. Look at the way that Avram is described by the Bnei Ches. Nasi atabte b'sacheno. They recognized his moral greatness. That's what it means to be a Yashar. And by the way, the Avos lived before the giving of the Torah, which means they didn't even have the possibility of the legal textbook in the same way that we do. And yet, they were Yashar. Perhaps maybe even because of the absence of the legal textbook, it was easier to be Yashar because you understood what the values were more than just the legal system. That's what's described, that's what's called Sefer Yashar. And so therefore, there's numerous examples in Halacha of where we learn these things. So as an example, Rambam says in Source 11 that there's a notion of Zerizus, of alacrity. Where do we learn that from? Vayashkem Avram Baboker. There's ideas of that. So that's the Gemara in Yuma. Then we know that the idea of caring enough about one's neighbors to even rebuke them, right? No, meaning to say, not the American way, which is just to live and let live and let them die and let die, because I don't care what's happening to them, is to get involved enough to say, I care about you. You know that your water's still on. You know that the way you do things, you're probably going to get a ticket. I'm going to tell you something because I care enough about you, about my neighbors, that we learn from the fact that Avram Avinu is willing to go to bat for Saddam. meaning these are ideas which are bigger than simply the law itself. These are examples and many, many, many examples of what is called descriptive values. I remember I was on a flight recently and I was having this debate. I was at a Yarche Kala down in Florida a year ago, and one of the topics we had the opportunity of learning with Rabbi J.J. Shaft, and he was talking about this topic of to care enough to give rebuke and the difficulties of giving rebuke because people are not going to respond to it. And I was on the plane back, and it was still the time when flights you had to be all masked, right? And it was at the time where things were still flaring up and the whole business. And I was on the plane, and it was amazing because two rows ahead of me was this couple. I think it must have been a Chabad couple, and they spent the entire flight learning Torah. It was amazing, just like with each other. They were learning, and it was beautiful just to listen to. And the difficulty was they were also the only two people on the flight who weren't masked, and I was like the back of the row. And the stewardess was like busy talking about this couple, that couple that was the problem couple, and they kept on coming over to them and so on. And I was so torn, you know, because it's so beautiful. On the other hand, it's like, clearly flaunting the laws. And I don't care what you believe about masks and vaccines and who's in control of the vaccine and who, you know, Google's. I don't care about all your conspiracy theories. But if you're in a place where they say this is the rule, just act like they know you're Jewish, right? They know you're Jewish. So just pretend you care about everybody else. Forget about what you believe in, right? You know, like Google invented the virus. Okay, it's magnetic. Okay, but like just behave in the way that's so. And so I was debating this, and I was waiting for my luggage. Because I actually had brought carry-on, but guess what got checked. Okay, so I was waiting at the... It was one of those flights, you know, like those flights you spend the whole time like you. Anyway, so I came out there and they were sitting there and I said, shouldn't I? And I said, I want to tell you something else. Two rows behind you, the Torah was unbelievable. I've never been on a flight, but I've heard such beautiful learning between a husband and wife. They're just sitting there and I said, but I also want you to know that I was listening to the stewardess and they were busy talking about those people. And when they talk about those people, because of this, I said, it's so easy to make a Kiddush Hashem, but make a Kiddush Hashem properly, right? And the moment I said that, the eyes went blank, and that was it, checked out. I wasn't listening, who cares, some idiot telling me. So it's so hard to do this, but you have to care. The point is, but we learn this actually, the Torah quantifies it later on by Hachech Tachech Samisecho, but it describes it early on. Now, by the way, what's the danger in this model of, this model of value, conveying values?
Conforming to society too much.
That's not so much of a danger. That's a loss, right? But the danger of this is that description is open to the interpreter, right? So that's the danger of this, is that I could read Sefer Bereishis and learn from Shimon and Levi that when I don't like people, I just wipe out the city, right? So the point is that you need a little bit of guidance, moral guidance, when it comes to how to exercise description, right? So otherwise, I could end up doing terrible and heinous crimes. But so it requires a Masorah. It requires a certain tradition accompanying that description, or otherwise I will arrive at the end of the wrong conclusion. The problem with the description, descriptive, is it's sometimes a little hard to do this, although I think that we do have a sense of truth and rash. When we know we're justifying, then we know that we're wrong. The third place is, I think, a little more interesting, and we're going to spend a little more time on this in 2 weeks' time, is what's called inductive. So induction, just as a quick reminder for those who appreciate mathematical induction. You know, you remember how induction works as opposed to deduction? So induction is where I need to induce a rule. So I have a pattern. You know, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So I have to induce the rule, and the rule in that case is what's called n+1. That's the rule of the series, which is the number plus one. Right. Then it gets more complicated when you have things like 1, 4, 9, 16, 25. Then what's the rule then? The induction is n squared. But then it gets more complicated. You understand? So we can just start making the series or the details more complicated to induce a more complex rule. So what induction is looking at the outcome, the details, and saying what's the rule behind this? What is the formula for the series behind this? That's the process of induction. By the way, that's the methodological way that Gemara conveys or Mishnah conveys education. It's inductive, not deductive. If it was deductive, or if it was, it would be laid out in front of us, and then we can deduce the results. But here it is actually a conversation about X, and then we have to realize that X, actually, that debate means to say that the value behind it is Y. That's called induction. If I'm listening to an example I give in America is if you're listening to a cricket match and you have to figure out the rules from listening to the commentator. Right? So you hear about all kinds of things and it's like, it all sounds completely foreign, right? It's the same as when I first listened to a baseball match, right, where it's all completely foreign, but you suddenly put the pieces together, a triple header, like where's the third head? Like, you know, like all these things, you know, like you suddenly start putting all the pieces together, you induce the rule. So the same is true about Torah. So a number of examples is this. Actually, just a number of years ago, Abby gave me the opportunity of visiting the offices of the Honorable Jack Weinstein, of blessed memory, at the age of 95, I think we went, when he was still rendering decisions in the district court. And his topic was, he gave an annual lecture on environment, on a topic in Judaism, and he wanted to talk about environmentalism. This is around 2015. When it was a sort of change of presidencies, he was worried about the future, and he wanted to talk about environmentalism and Judaism's relationship with it, and he really wanted to have a specific, you know, a specific mandate that Judaism talks about environmentalism. And we went through a number of the topics, and we put together a beautiful collation of material on this topic. And the truth is that it's not so easy to say that the Torah demands X, not Y. Because the Torah, in this case, actually we can induce principles, but we can't prescribe principles, as an example. So, like, there's multiple times where the Torah talks about the idea, but how we apply it is somewhat more complicated. But the rule is induced. So, as an example, the Torah talks about how that human beings are placed in the Garden of Eden. La'avda l'shamra. La'avda is to cultivate, to develop, to expand. L'shamra is to preserve and not to destroy. Right. So we see examples of this where the Sefer HaChinuch talks about, let's say, sorcery or basar v'chalav, like meat and milk, are all examples where we start mixing different species lines. We start playing games with the way that nature is to destroy it in a way that's incorrect or beyond correction, and that is considered improper. We hear about ideas like when we are supposed to besiege cities and how we treat the trees of that city, not simply the fruit trees, cannot be destroyed. And the Sefer HaChinuch says in source 16. Although technically speaking, Baal Tashchis is in the situation of war, and specifically a fruit tree, it also applies itself in the lunchroom. It also applies itself in other aspects of life, in our commercialism, the way that we deal with things, and that when something's broken, we don't fix it, we discard it and replace it. The fact that when something's half empty, we throw it out and just buy something new. It's meant to convey to us rules. Other examples in the Torah is where the Midrash says in the Kohelet, it's Rabbi, Re'eyes Ma'aseh Elokim Ki Miyu Cholot Ha'Kenes Asher Yivsoi Apostolik in Kohelet. Hashem gave a tour of Gan Eden to Adam and says, look how beautiful my natural ecosystem is. I created for you human beings. To make sure not to destroy it. So again, multiple different points. The Torah is not prescribing a specific policy. The Torah is telling us values which we put together, we get a sense, we induce that the Torah does care about environment. Another example is in halachic terminology. There are certain things which are not allowed to be in yeshuv, in settled areas. And one of them is, one of those things is that we're not allowed to have is ashpasois or kivshanois. We're not allowed to have industrial plants, or let's say, like, you know, furnaces and kilns within the yeshuv where people are living, because it affects other people, right? So we convey these ideas. Now, if you're to say, well, specifically, how far away, you know, is this? The Gemara does prescribe it. But to what about a chemical plant today? You know, what about pipelines that run from a cat? There's complicated questions which have to be answered. Where do cruise ships, right, commercial cruises, where are they allowed to let out all their garbage? You know, what do we do with subway cars? You know, all these questions that arise today. What about the sinking islands in the mid-Pacific and global warming? These are real issues, right? And how do we? So the Torah is not saying a specific policy, but from all the touch points, these ideas, we see there is a value in the Torah of looking after the world and not destroying. We see there is a value in the idea of respecting yeshuv. These are examples of where we have to induce. Now, it is left up to us to understand the Torah. The Torah does not believe in commercialism. The Torah believes in usage for specific good. But ultimately, how does that look like? More complicated to apply itself. Similarly, when it comes to damage, you know, let's say that you have a great insurance policy, you're at the end of your car lease, and then somebody really annoying is bothering you. You could, technically speaking, say, well, if I just rear-end them, right, they're going to have to pay a whole lot more than me, right? So, and I can drive off and everything's fine. So does the Torah allow this? So the Torah actually never says the principle of don't damage somebody else's property. You know that? The Torah never says that. The Torah talks about paying for other people's damage to property. So you could say, well, I'll take it, I'll bite it, because I really want to create them aggravation. I know how long it is at the body shop. I've got my neighbor's an auto body repair fellow. He'll take care of it in one, and they'll have to go and send their car in 3 weeks. And so I'll swallow the money and take care of it. How do we know that it's not allowed? So the reason again is through induction. As an example, the Torah tells us in source 19 about Ashur. Imshur nagachu mitmal shavu ba'valu ishvenu. If let's say your ox goes and kills, God forbid, you have to pay, and there's even perhaps a potential theoretical death penalty on such a person. And then we hear in source 21, you cannot stand by where your brother's blood is being spilled. In source 22, you can't deny, you can't steal, you can't withhold wages. The Torah says, Rabbeinu Yaakov, the son of the Rosh, the precursor to Shulchan Aruch, says in source 23, in what is the Choshen Mishpat today, he called it Choshen Mishpat, Keshem she'asu lignov ligzol mimen mamon chaver. You're not allowed to damage as in the same way that you're not allowed to steal. As long as it's within your control, you do not have the right to damage another person. Where did he learn this from? The Torah never said it. He learns it from the fact that the Torah talks so much about the responsibility of paying, that the Torah obviously assumes that damaging itself is a problem itself. So this is even in the halachic world, is you can induce laws. We're going to take a look in more detail when we have a little more time, in a couple of weeks' time, at a specific example which will deal with animal rights, hopefully, in terms of Torah law, and what the Torah law says, and perhaps some of the induction principles there, which is a fascinating example, case in point. But be it as it may, we have three different angles. How does the Torah convey meta values? Answer is, meta ideas, values. One is it tells us sometimes the value. That's prescriptive. Sometimes it will describe a value which we're supposed to learn from that, because that's the most easy way to learn with the danger of misinterpretation. That was induction, right? Where we'll see that there will be a number of different touch points or facts which come together to produce a rule, produce a value, a larger arc into what Judaism is expecting of us. And this therefore leads us to an interesting conclusion. I'd like to end with the introduction to the sefer called Ma'alos HaTorah, which is actually the brother of the Vilna Gaon. You know, sometimes we always become a relative of somebody, right? Right? At some point in time, we're somebody's child, and then we're somebody's sibling, and then we're somebody's spouse, and then we're somebody's parent, and then we're somebody's grandparent. So we always become somebody, right? Which is good, because that means you've got important people in your family, right? It's good. So he was the brother of Vilna Gaon. He wrote a book called Ma'alos HaTorah, a very short sefer, where he says, and this is a beautiful, and we'll close with this. He says, "V'shamati me'achi ha'gonzal, shoresh ha'davar, shebevad ha'leka le'meymar, we cannot say, you cannot say there's only 613 mitzvahs in the last source in 24. Because then, technically speaking, there's only three mitzvahs from the first, really essentially one-fifth of the entire Torah. There are many parashiyos which don't seem to include a single mitzvah. Clearly, that's not acceptable. Ela. Be'emes called dibur v'dibur b'Torah she'atzayim mipiagvura hu mitzvah b'fnei atzmo. It is possible to look at the Torah that every word, every pasuk contains a mitzvah. And you may say, wait a second, when we're learning the descendants of Esav at the end of Parshas Vayishlach, what mitzvah is there? But he's saying that if one looks hard enough, if one's able to distill enough, you can see that in fact in the marriage systems of Esav, and who Timnah marrying the Eliphaz, and Timnah wanted to be part of Yaakov, and there's actually a mitzvah, there's actually laws about how we treat those who perhaps are not appropriate to be married in, but how we reject people is even learned from places like that. And therefore, he says, if you look at the Torah as a whole, don't limit it, don't quantify it as 613 mitzvahs and that's the cap. There's much more to the Torah as a whole, which now leads us, and we'll close it with a question. And that is that when the Torah is conveying to us these ideas, and there's the different ways of phrasing this question, is the Torah aligning itself with principles which we know to be just independently? Meaning, if we were left on a desert island, brought up by the wolves, and we were to be then confronted with a particular idea, would we nod and say that idea makes sense? Is Hashem trying to align with what is, we'll call it, the true north in every human being, and then really we have that inside of us? Or do you say that, no, God said something, And because he said it, it became moral, and that's why we are more notea, we are more inclined in that direction. Which is it? Is God choosing something which is externally moral? And therefore the question is, so where does that come from? Does God give credence to that? Where did that come if it's not outside of his word, technically speaking? Or do you say that his word is what actually created morality itself? That's the question one step back from what we're doing, which is the space for morality in the world. Folks, we'll hold it here. Thank you so much for taking the time. Look forward, Mr. Shem, to continuing our learning together.